Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. For our Thanksgiving show, we revisit some of our favorite stories from this year. A smorgasbord of music, poetry, and even a retelling of America's history in rap. I'm Monica Velez.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We also give you a break from holiday stress by returning to a century-old Buddhist temple in Fresno's Chinatown. Its new owners are creating a meditation center. And if you're still hungry post-Thanksgiving, we've got dessert, the oldest Japanese confectionery in the valley.
Espérame en el cielo, corazón, si es que te vas primero.
But first, we're going to revisit the sound of 18-year-old Delano musician Anaí Morales. Last summer, she released her first mariachi album. You're hearing the album's title song, Espérame en el Cielo.
Espérame en el cielo, corazón.
In the story, which aired back in August, I take you to where Morales grew up. Morales was just six when she joined her first mariachi band. She plays the violin, guitar, guitarrón, and trumpet.
I would say it's like a lifestyle, you know? Because if I'm not teaching it or performing it, singing it in the shower, singing it while I clean the house, you know, it's always there.
On this summer day, she's getting ready to sing at the dining room table. But first, she has to quiet her dogs.
Be nice, Toulouse.
And make sure she's in the right key by playing the beginning of the music to the song, Nuestro Gran Amor, off of her phone. Then she sings a cappella.
Como el sol le hace falta la luna, pues sin él no podría darnos luz.
The record label is Little Village Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization that seeks out artists from many different musical and cultural traditions who might not be heard outside of their communities, and it produces their music at no expense. But Morales has been heard. She's traveled around the country performing with a Delano band called Mariachi Mestizos. For a long time, she dreamed about singing in one particular place.
I used to have a poster of Carnegie Hall in my room, and it was like Carnegie Hall from the perspective of you on the stage. So you just see all the seats and the lights and everything.
And on April 10th, 2017, she made it to that stage.
And it was epic, like just extremely beautiful, like the colors, I don't know, It literally felt like magic, just like looking at it.
She watched from the side as the seats filled up, and soon the lights were shining on her face.
I just told myself, okay, like, you're only gonna do this once. You gotta give it all you've got and try to remember every moment of it.
And there's another more recent memory she'll never forget, the day she got accepted to Harvard.
When I looked at the screen, I saw it like throws confetti on the screen when you open it. And so I saw that and I was like, wait, what? Like,
that's good.
Yeah. I was like, really, I was just like shook, you know? And my sisters were on FaceTime.
Morales says she was crying. Her two sisters were crying and her parents were screaming. One of her sisters is already at Harvard. And Morales says she's excited to be in the same place with her again. That sister is also a musician, and together they're going to play at Harvard's Mariachi Club.
So we're going to take it over this year, me and her together.
And she can also share her new album. It's a compilation of 13 of her favorite cover songs, plus one song that her dad wrote about the first time it snowed in Kern County. You're hearing that song now.
gran sufrimiento.
Her dad, Juan Morales, runs a mariachi studio in Delano. That's where she recorded the album. Juan says the record started only with her voice and a guitar.
And then they said, well, why don't you play this song with the harp? Oh, okay, I'll play the harp. And I play the harp with another song. And then, why don't we add two violins? Okay, well, let's do two violins. And, well, let's put trumpet here. And why don't we use the mariachi? And all of a sudden, there's a 30-piece orchestra.
Before moving to the Valley, Juan played in professional mariachis around the world. He was in Los Camperos, Mariachi Cobre, and La Mariachi Sol de Mexico. He also taught it to all three of his daughters, the two going to Harvard and another who now lives in L.A. She's a director at a music school. Juan says it all started before they were born.
We used to play music in the womb for them. And my wife would put some contraption that we designed, and we played music, you know, constantly while they were being made.
It had a lasting effect. The family still plays together.
The most exciting thing is that we get to spend the evenings together, you know, my wife and I and our kids. We've been fortunate to have, you know, this opportunity for our girls.
And everyone in the family has taught in the mariachi studio. Anani Morales says she tells her students to challenge themselves in everything they do.
The second that it's easy, you're not learning anything. You're not growing from it. And so that's the advice I would give to anyone who wants to do anything, you know? It's just, you have to make sure that you always challenge yourself so that you can grow.
Por la blanda arena que lame el mar.
And as she heads to Harvard, she'll take that advice with her. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez. And just to update you, I spoke with Morales this week. She's doing well at Harvard, where she's a pre-med major. And yes, she is singing in the university's mariachi club. In fact, the group just had its first concert, a sold-out show. Morales says she even got to sing one of the songs on her album.
Sabe Dios que angustia te acompañó.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. We all know Thanksgiving is a holiday remembering the European settlers in what's now the United States. So we thought it fitting to re-air our story about a show billed as America Then, Told by America Now. We're talking about the Broadway musical Hamilton, and specifically its San Francisco tour. The role of George Washington is being played by a Bakersfield native. FM89's Laura Satsui met him at San Francisco's Orpheum Theater, just outside the stage where it all happens.
The foyer is bustling after a Sunday matinee. The busy theater and Darnell Abraham's new role make it a little harder for him to go unnoticed.
One of the adjustments for me has been, you know, just kind of going out in public. Folks will come up and ask, you know, are you Washington in Hamilton?
Abraham stepped into the role of George Washington for the San Francisco company of Hamilton a month ago and says he's still learning about the nation's first president.
And my goal with Washington is to strip away the icon and is to really embody the humanity so that we see a man who, yes, was confident, but yet we also see a man who had fears, a man who, when Right Hand Man comes out, Washington is just really laying it out, saying, you know, we are outgunned, outmanned, I need help.
We are outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned. We gotta make an all-out stand. Hey, yo, I'm gonna need a right-hand man.
There aren't any recordings of Abraham as Washington, so we'll be referring to the original Broadway cast album. In that album, Christopher Jackson plays George Washington. Hamilton the musical tells the story of Alexander Hamilton, one of the nation's founding fathers. During the American Revolution, Hamilton became George Washington's right-hand man. Still, the Virginian war hero looms large throughout the performance.
He is the founding father, and he's our nation's first president. I think in context of this show, I would say he's the adult in the room. He becomes Hamilton's father figure.
The show isn't just a retelling of history. It considers and reckons with some of the nation's messier issues, like war, slavery, and political compromise.
I remember sitting in a studio back in New York City when I was learning the role, and the song History Has Its Eyes on You. I remember being moved to tears to the point where I actually had to stop working and just let it happen. There's a line in there that says, who lives, who dies, who tells your story? You have no control.
You have no control. Who lives, who dies, who tells your story? I know that we can win. I know that greatness lies in you. But remember from here on in, history has its eyes.
Here I am, fast forward 2019, a black man telling a story about an America then. And I just remember feeling overwhelmed with emotion, gratitude, I would even dare say a sense of grief. I am a descendant of enslaved Africans here in America. But in the midst of all of that, I feel empowered. Because here at this time in our nation's history, I have an opportunity to be a voice for those who were once voiceless.
That's something that makes Hamilton special. It's a show about the mostly white men who helped establish the U.S., told in rap, R&B, and hip-hop music by people of color. Abraham says he learned some of the show's dance styles growing up in Bakersfield.
Both of my sisters are dancers, and so, you know, one of them would think of some new dance routine, and they need another body, so my sisters, they would pull me in, and so I would learn very simple street dance steps, and then I also remember stepping, and we see elements of that in the show.
Despite the twist on musical theater, Abraham's mom, Loane Powell, says it's a great opportunity to see history retold.
Now it allows for our children, like for my grandchildren, they're taught this in school, but we're going to take them to see the play and have it performed by people who look like them, which is going to catch their attention.
She and her husband, Tyrone Powell, have already seen the show in San Francisco, but not with their son as George Washington. When they attended, Abraham was playing Aaron Burr.
I have one friend that, when he was a little boy, she said, he's going to be president. And so she texted me and she said, I told you he was going to be president.
Powell adds that what also makes this show special is that she always told her children to learn from history because it always comes back around. To prepare for the show, immersing himself in history is what Abraham has done.
When you go into his room, like, he's watching documentaries on George Washington, he's watching documentaries on King George, just so he could get a deeper understanding for all these characters.
That's Lily Ling, the music director and conductor for the San Francisco Company of Hamilton. Abraham says when he was in school, there wasn't really a hometown musical theater role model for him to look up to.
I had my dreams and my ambitions. I remember watching Denzel Washington movies and being inspired by him. I remember watching Sidney Poitier.
I can only imagine. I know. So I'm from Fresno, and Audra McDonald is like...
Correct.
You know, you were like the Bakersfield Audra McDonald.
Oh my gosh. The fact that you just put Audra McDonald and I in the same sentence. Audra, I hope you're listening to this because that is... I'm stuttering over my words right now. That's huge.
But Abraham does realize he's a role model for others now. Just last week, he flew back to Bakersfield to see his old school, former teachers, and current students at Dr. Juliet Thorner Elementary School.
My grandmother would always say, pay it forward. And so it was a really unique and wonderful opportunity to do just that, to say thank you, but also to now go and just sit down with the kids, you know, talk about what makes them excited.
He says Hamilton feels like a celebration because he's in his home state, near family, and he's had the chance to say thank you. He's focusing on the show in front of him and just feeling lucky to be alive right now. Hamilton will be performing in San Francisco at the Orpheum Theater through January. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui in San Francisco.
Since we aired that story, the show's run in San Francisco has been extended through May of 2020. Darnell Abraham has confirmed that he'll remain in the role of George Washington through the new year. We all know the holidays can be overwhelming and chaotic. Sometimes we even feel like we're about to lose it. Well, I'm going to replay a story about a century-old Buddhist temple in Fresno's Chinatown that may put you in a more relaxed space. The temple was built by first-generation Japanese immigrants, the Issei, mostly field workers who made very little money but still managed to fund the elaborate structure. But in 2010, after much soul-searching, the long-standing Japanese-American congregation moved north of downtown and put the historic property up for sale. It finally sold last year. So who bought it? In this story, I introduce you to the new owners. There are signs the temple is coming to life again. A newly erected metal fence around the property, a few cars in the parking lot, and inside the third-story ordination hall, voices. Four women sit on cushions in the middle of the large room. Antique pendant lights hang from a ceiling with intricate woodwork. Large windows let in lots of light. The women face two Burmese monks in brown robes and recite the five precepts of Buddhism. No drinking or drugs, no lying, no adultery, and...
You are not going to be stealing anything. You're not going to kill anyone.
That's Tane Lin. He's part of Fresno's small Burmese American community.
This is where all the Burmese people come and meditate. Not only necessarily Burmese people, not necessarily Buddhist people. Anyone who is willing to come and meditate here, they can join us. We're welcome to do that here.
Lin's a doctor. It's kind of a theme here. The four women who are meditating, they're retired doctors. And Lin and several other physicians raised the $750,000 to purchase the landmark temple last summer. It's now called Marak U Dama. The goal is to make it a monastery and a meditation center. At the front of the hall is a colorful shrine with a large Buddha. It's hand-carved, covered in gold leaf. It was recently shipped from Burma, or what's now called Myanmar. There's a smaller Buddha to the left.
So when we bought this property, we found this statue in this storeroom. Oh, I was so excited.
It turns out a mayor from a small Burmese town presented this Buddha to the city of Fresno in 1961. The city then gave it to the temple, where it was stored after the Japanese-American congregation left.
Hey, can you give it to me? Can we save it?
They agreed the Burmese Buddha belonged here. Plus, they were thrilled the new buyers were Buddhist.
Amazing. This is from Burma since like 50 years ago.
Does it make you feel like, oh, we do need to be here?
Yes, very. Yeah, we meant to be here, I think. Yeah.
There are even two monks who traveled all the way from Myanmar to reside here temporarily.
People call my name very short, like Pinya, but Pinya Langara is a full name.
Pinya Langara has been here for about 6 months. He says young people like him are curious about how many different ethnic groups there are in the U.S.
And also learn how the different people live together.
And closer afield, Burmese Americans from L.A. and San Francisco have also come to help fix up the property. Fresno local Ken Ng has rebuilt cabinet doors inside. And outside, he points to some of his carpentry work.
This door, see the wood door?
Yes.
I replaced.
Ng's not a doctor, but he's married to one. I ask him to spell his last name, Ng, and he confuses me when he says, nice guy.
Nice guy?
No, okay.
Yeah, just an N and G, so the people, they're asking me how to spell it. You know nice guy? That's a N and G, that's it.
Nice guy, funny guy. We walk through the building that's behind the temple, a large fellowship hall with a kitchen. There's five decades of memories here, weddings, festivals. And back up a few steps through a door going outside to a large tree with heart-shaped leaves.
Okay, Raymond, do you want to talk about the trees?
Yeah.
That's Raymond Koh. He's not a medical doctor.
I'm a dentist.
Yeah. But he's married to one.
Where's my script?
He doesn't really need a script.
It's a banyan tree. It's family of a fig tree, okay? And this is a sacred tree for us because Buddha was enlightened under this tree.
Well, not this particular tree.
How? Because when the real tree died in the Buddha in India, it was cloned. One clone was sent to Ceylon, and that clone, we got this clone from Ceylon to here, so it's kind of related.
I asked him how that happened. How did the temple get a seedling from a Bodhi tree in what is now Sri Lanka?
I don't know. The Japanese did it, not me.
Yeah, that's come with the property.
That's come with the property.
It comes with the property, along with the goodwill of the Japanese-American congregation who built and cared for this unique temple for decades. Now it's in the hands of newer immigrants who will tell their own stories while tending to the Bodhi tree. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Monica Velez. Giving thanks and giving back are part of the Thanksgiving holiday. In this story, giving back means educating people about the importance of the 2020 census, which ultimately translates to how much federal funding an area might get. The San Joaquin Valley is home to some of the hardest to count areas in the entire country. But as I reported back in July, local organizations are already out canvassing in an effort to get more people on board. The town of Huron isn't a place you just stumble upon. It's isolated and surrounded by miles and miles of fields.
It's a small farmworking community for the most part. That's how I would describe it.
That's Aurora Ramirez. She grew up in Huron and still works here at a nonprofit community resource center. This laid-back but passionate advocate is driving me around town in her black Honda. We get to a dirt field that's just a short distance from a residential neighborhood. The road's rocky and bumpy. There's no clear pathway for cars or any type of sidewalk. But in the middle of the field, there's an old rundown warehouse.
That packing house has people living there. People are not going to assume that there is people living here, and there is.
And Ramirez says field workers have been living here for years. They use tin, tarps, cardboard, or whatever they can find to build a home. There are pockets of these makeshift homes all over town and the San Joaquin Valley. And they don't all have legitimate addresses, meaning the Census Bureau may not know people live there. So how did these people get counted in past censuses?
I don't think they do. They're seemed as if they're not even existing addresses. So then we, not only are we facing problems with people that don't have an actual address, but ones that have an address that is not considered a physical address.
That's one of the reasons Huron is considered a hard-to-count community. That means a significant portion of the population hasn't been accounted for in past census counts. And according to the Census Bureau, the San Joaquin Valley is home to some of the hardest-to-count places in the country.
I would say, generally speaking, hard-to-count communities tend to be people of color, low-income, immigrants, limited English proficient, children under five whose parents tend to fall under the categories that I just mentioned.
That's Cindy Quesada. She's a senior program officer for the center, a health advocacy nonprofit that's heading 2020 census outreach and research in parts of Central California. Through her research, Quesada found part of the challenge is getting people to understand participating is important because it impacts how communities are funded.
I would say that, you know, census data is used to, you know, to plan, right, for like where schools should be and how many schools should be in a, you know, particular section because it's based on population.
Then Quesada says most get on board. But Ellen Brav-Guajardo says it's still a huge challenge. She's also with the center.
Passing out pencils or passing out pamphlets or, you know, PSAs about, hey, it's census time. That is not gonna work. Being able to hear what their particular concerns are about, being able to give them some response to at least be able to make the case for why it's worth whatever they're perceiving as the risk, and being and really offering folks a helping hand.
The goal is to count as many people as possible. It's part of the state project, the California Complete Count, so that Californians get their fair share of federal resources and even representation, because it turns out the amount of political representatives depend on population. After the last census, the Valley got an additional state Senate seat, District 16, in part because of the census work the Dolores Huerta Foundation did. The executive director, Camila Chavez, says collaboration is key.
And I know that that's what helped us 10 years ago when it came to our work in Kern County, is that we were working with our census partners as well as other community groups to get the word out.
Fireball Council member Felipe Perez joins us on our last stop in Huron. He says art is helping promote the census too.
Try to make some murals showing the importance about the census 2020 with some kind of picture as worker, field workers, and you're gonna see right now the first one that we are doing it over here in Huron.
The mural is only partially done. The words 2020 census hang above the farmers' fruits and vegetables that are sketched out. Perez's murals are going to be painted in other communities too, so people all over the valley can look at them and ask themselves, why does the 2020 census matter to me?
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. As you've probably noticed, we're tapping into the themes of Thanksgiving as we revisit stories from this year. But for some of the issues we cover, the problems run deep. They can't be solved with a single donation or day of volunteering. In Kern County, that includes the reach of the opioid crisis. Data suggest more than 4,000 people suffering from opioid use disorder lack access to effective treatment in that county. In this feature from June, part of the ongoing series In Recovery, FM89's Carrie Klein tells us about one Kern County woman who's made it her mission to connect her community to care.
Earlier this spring, a few dozen people sat in a Bakersfield conference room in front of a table piled high with nondescript white boxes, each one about the size of a shoebox. Among those was Heather Menzel, who couldn't wait to grab as many as possible from the man sitting behind the table.
So how many do you guys want?
As many as we can all collectively get together.
Inside each one is a dozen smaller boxes of naloxone, the drug that can stop an opioid overdose cold.
So there's 48 in here.
All together?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
This county and state-sponsored event provides training and free naloxone kits to community members all around Kern County. Menzel has nabbed about 60 kits to bring back to Lake Isabella, where she lives in the isolated Kern River Valley, about 40 miles outside Bakersfield.
For, I would say, regular everyday problems, there's not a lot of services, let alone a lot of services for people that have substance use disorders or alcoholism or mental health disorders.
This event is part of the state's naloxone distribution program, which has dispersed $16 million worth of the drug throughout California. In the Kern River Valley, Menzel and her colleagues say they know of at least three times the drug has been used. Critics say it enables drug use, but the medical community agrees it saves lives. Menzel says she's handed them out to users, providers, and also everyday people looking out for each other.
I want to cry just thinking about a couple of the people that I've given one to. They just feel like they're doing something when they feel so helpless in saving the life of their loved one.
4 years ago, Menzel was one of those people in need of help. But today, she's sober. The petite 36-year-old with bright eyes and a Hello Kitty tattoo on her left arm is a full-time student, full-time waitress, and full-time mom to a 4-year-old named Isabella Sunshine.
I'm going to turn my window down, Mama.
Okay, baby, here, let me take your temp shoes off. Okay, I got you signed up for recital pictures tomorrow.
It's Menzel's busiest night of the week, and she hustles around the valley in her heavy-duty Ford Excursion.
Mommy!
First stop, drop Bella off at dance class. On her way to the door, Bella picks up something from the parking lot and goes to put it in her mouth.
No, don't touch it. That's disgusting.
I'll put it in my shoe.
No, I don't want that in your shoe. Gross.
While Bella's in class, Menzel and I sit down at a picnic table where she tells me her daughter was the turning point in her life, the thing that helped her turn her back on drugs for good. Menzel says she first used meth when she was just 12 or 13.
Before you know it, you know, you wake up and you're 18 and you haven't graduated high school, and all of a sudden you're not just a partier, you realize you're a drug addict, you know?
In her 20s, she says she switched from meth to heroin.
And I did heroin all the way up until I got pregnant with my first child at the age of 32, and that's when I got sober.
But she didn't just flip a switch. She had gotten into a medication-assisted treatment program where she got methadone every day, but the clinic was an hour away in Bakersfield.
But I was still homeless, in an abusive relationship, living in a garage,
You know, I didn't have any money to get down there every day. When you can't get down there every day, then they kicked me off, even though I was pregnant. They told me I was too much of a liability and that they couldn't help me anymore.
One night, it hit her what a bad spot she was in.
And I just remember crying out to God. I hadn't prayed in years, like the most earnest prayer I've ever prayed in my whole entire life.
She says around 4 a.m., the phone started ringing and ringing and ringing. Finally, she picked it up. It was her mother.
I'm going to start crying when I tell this part of the story.
They had been estranged for years, ever since Menzel had pawned her mother's wedding rings to feed her habit.
She said, they're going to let you back on treatment, and I'm going to drive you down there myself every day, and you're not going to lose this baby. And she did.
Those first few weeks were hard, but eventually Menzel moved back in with her mom and stepdad. She had Bella, and earlier this year, she even finished methadone for good. Now she's helping take care of her niece, Jordan Mendoza, who adores Bella.
Did you have fun dancing? Dancing, dancing.
The 27-year-old is recovering from meth abuse, and she says Menzel was there for her when Mendoza got out of prison a few weeks ago. She had served 10 months on felony burglary charges.
Because she's the best positive influence that I have. She's my best friend, you know what I mean? She comes home from work, and I'm like, woo, my friend's home, you know?
Positive influences are important in the Kern River Valley. This region of only 10,000 people consistently reports one of the highest rates of fatal opioid overdoses in the county, mostly from heroin, which also sends dozens of people to hospitals and emergency rooms each year. And of the county's 47 prescribers waivered to offer treatment medication, zero work in the Kern River Valley. Only one clinic and one independent therapist offer outpatient substance abuse counseling. The county, however, is working to improve those numbers, and the local hospital has a grant to expand access to substance abuse care. A new community action network is also doing its own grassroots work.
Oh, yeah, we probably got to go right now. What time is it?
5:13.
Okay.
And around a year ago, Heather Menzel helped establish a new recovery group.
Are we supposed to get anybody else? Is that it?
After Bella's dance class, Menzel shuttles friends over to Faith Community Church in Woburn Heights. It's their local chapter of the 12-step program Celebrate Recovery, where I love you is a normal part of conversation.
Salvation, grace, mercy, all that, God has given it to you and it's unlimited. But we still have to do the footwork. We have to do our part.
Before separating into support groups, the pastor delivers a sermon to around 40 enrapt people. Two tell me it's the best recovery group they've ever joined.
Guys, thank you. Seriously, we're going to have we always close with the serenity prayer.
One of the organizers is Ron Hagler, who's recovering from meth and alcohol abuse. He went to high school with Menzel, and he attributes a lot of this positive momentum to her.
She makes time to help the next person. She engages and she recruits and she brings people to the table. She's got a heart of gold, and it's purely out of wanting to see the next person have help.
When she's not out and about, Menzel is studying to get a bachelor's degree in addiction counseling. Her hope that a medication-assisted treatment clinic offering methadone or buprenorphine will someday come to the Kern River Valley.
This is my home and this is my community, and now that I see all the beautiful things here, I want to be a part of that and I want to use my degree locally to help our community. That's like the sole purpose.
And maybe someday, hundreds of boxes of naloxone won't be necessary. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Monica Velez. For Thanksgiving, we're bringing back some of our favorite segments from this year. And while we're thinking about family and community this holiday, we revisit an interview with Fresno's fourth poet laureate, Marisol Baca. The Fresno State alumna co-founded the Women Writers of Color's Central Valley Collective to support other female authors and poets. She calls it a space to break bread and uplift others. FM89's Laura Sutsui spoke to Baca about what she wants to accomplish during her 2-year tenure as the city's literary ambassador.
So Marisol, you grew up partially in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and partially in Fresno, and it was in some of your elementary school classes here that you wrote some of your first poems. Did you know or even consider in grade school that you wanted to be a writer or a poet?
No, I didn't know at that time in my life that I wanted to be a poet, but I recognized very early on, probably around second and third grade, that I always wanted to write and to imagine and to create. And it was in third grade that I had an instructor invite a poet from Fresno, a Fresno poet, Jean Jansen, to come and do a talk about poetry. And she did a little lesson, and I wrote a poem. It was my first poem. And after that, I was hooked. I always wanted to write, and I kept writing since the very beginning. Since third grade on, I was probably already writing little small lyrics or poems or songs, but it was around that time, third and fourth grade, that I really developed a love for language and for poetry writing. And I wrote that little poem about a butterfly.
Do you remember the poem?
I remember a little bit of it, and it went, the butterfly is so beautiful to me, but he is so wrinkly. His colors are the colors of my dreams, the reds, the blues, and even the greens. So I was already interested in rhyming and thinking about poetry in its very basic sense as well. But it was a pretty successful poem even for that age.
Yeah, that's kind of wonderful. It's like you can really compare your changing style from third grade even to now. And which leads me to my next question. I mean, where do you feel like the influence in your poetry even comes from? Is it something you've just made yourself? Or, I mean, when I think of rhyming, I think of kind of like Dr. Seuss and those sorts of things. But maybe, I don't know, or is it Fresno poets that have really influenced your poetry even today?
I think it's all of the above. I definitely had family that was interested. I was very lucky to grow up with a family that was interested in literature. And I remember reading when I got a little bit older, but reading some Federico Garcia Lorca in English and in Spanish, and my grandfather would read parts of that to me. I didn't understand the concepts that were in that poem, but I understood a love of repetition and a love of language even back then. And then obviously growing up pretty much primarily living in Fresno up until I was a young adult, I was influenced by a ton of amazing writers, Omar Salinas, Juan Felipe Herrera, Philip Levine. I went to Fresno State, and I had amazing writers that would come and visit Fresno State, but also faculty at Fresno State. That was really influential for me.
Wow. And so even now, you are now a teacher as well for college kids or college adults. And so you teach writing at Fresno City College, and you co-founded the Women Writers of Color Central Valley Collective. For those who aren't familiar, can you explain what the collective is?
Right. And to explain it, I think a really good way to start to is to say that with those influences, I was at an age when I was younger, about 18, 19 years old. I was reading Lorna D. Cervantes. I was reading Gloria Anzaldúa. I was reading a lot of women writers that I identified with and could see myself in their writing, Carmen Tafoya, but I didn't see a lot of that in Fresno, especially women of color. And I started to ask myself, where are the women writers of color in the Central Valley? And how, if there are women that can come together, how can I support them and work with them, and how can they support me and create a sense of community that I felt was, maybe it wasn't lacking, but could be strengthened, just like everything else, right? So I talked to a few of my good friends, all writers, and we came up with this idea that why don't we have a meeting once in a while? Why don't we break bread and eat and share our stories and share our struggles as being writers and focus on women and especially women of color? And that grew into the collective, which is Women Writers of Color, mostly a big giant dinner, pachanga, a big giant dinner where we all ate together, and there was a lot of us, and we talked about what we wanted to see. And that was a big part of it. And after that, monthly meetings where we discuss how to write a cover letter for sending our work out or submitting our work, and all of those kinds of things. From that to creating workshops for each other and to talk about our or writing. So it turned into a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people have taken parts of that and added to it, a number of different people that have been a part of Women Writers of Color. Women Writers of Color. Lots of W's.
It's okay. And we should point out that, so you're the fourth poet laureate for the city of Fresno, but you are the first female poet laureate. And so I guess you really touched on this. You started the collective or co-founded the collective to try and bring more women to light or bring them into the fold and say, hey, we can support each other. And so then I wonder, maybe you've already answered this a little bit, but do you notice a lot of female poets and women of color poets in the poetry and writing scene, like throughout all of your studies? You went to college in New York. I mean, was it different there, or everywhere you've been, have you felt like it's just women, female voices have not been as elevated as men's?
I don't think so. I think that one of the reasons why I chose to go to Cornell University was because Elena Viramontes, which is a fiction writer, an amazing fiction writer, prose writer. And I decided to go to Cornell. One of the reasons I decided to go to Cornell was because I wanted to work with her, because there were not many women of color that were full time in the creative writing department. So I really felt it was necessary for my growth as a writer to have a mentor that worked with me in that way. And so I do notice it, but I think especially notice it in that when I came back to Fresno, there was an explosion of women writers, fiction, nonfiction, all creative writing and poetry. There's an explosion and so many talented voices. And so I feel like something has happened where we are starting to become recognized. And being the first woman is an incredible honor, and I think very timely. And I'm happy to fill that role. I'm excited to fill that role. But we're going to see many more voices, many more poets that are in the Valley that are exceptional writers that are going to fill that role as well after me.
You've brought some poetry to read for us. Can we get into that? What would you like to read?
Yes, I think that I'll read a poem that is called Spiral, and it's a poem that's about three sisters, and it's also a poem about these spirals that show up in petroglyphs and all sorts of different ancient sites. And it's a spiral that goes inward and outward, and it also connects for me the idea or the concept of sisterhood. So this is titled Spiral, and it's for my sisters. Spiral. Three spirals bound to one another. Three sisters at the edge of a stone. What is the cosmos but a radial movement outward? To touch the fabric of one, to see the astral projection of the other, to forget for one moment that it is only a projection. Spiral is not spire, not arrows, not shields, not shells. It is a movement, the circles inside the corpus of a great tree. A slice of granite, a loop of river bone, our family of memory, the lost reflections of our arms and hands and our cheeks and our eyes. The reflection at the edge of the mirror, the sound of a voice as it travels up from the basement into the drawing room, absent of folk, absent of fire. A cold dream the dark earth has of clouds and air. The spire, the sword, embrace all ways to enter, touch the life force, touch that which only momentarily scrapes up against, spiral that bleeds a shaft of light as dust in a ray of sun floats in a doorway.
Thank you. So this 2-year term as Fresno's Poet Laureate has officially begun. And for you, what does that mean? What are you hoping you can get done as our literary ambassador?
I think that in the next 2 years, I'd like to work in two avenues. I really do see a need for writers, poets to go into classrooms. And I brought up earlier in the conversation, Laura, that I really developed this love for language in third and fourth grade. And I really want to go into classrooms and be that be that person, and also for other poets to go into those classrooms and talk about poetry and to get students excited about language. And so that's one of the things.
Yeah, so on a really practical level, getting poets to connect with the next generation.
Yes.
And
yes.
Awesome. Well, before we go, can you close us out with one more poem?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
This is the poem that I wrote for Fresno, and it's called The Origin of Certain Place Names. For Fresno, named for the abundant ash trees lining the San Joaquin River. I say Fresno, and the city blows out of my mouth as an exhale. I say Fresno and ask for her help in writing this poem. And she answers me when I give her time to speak. Her voice is chain, link, fence, bouncing, cry of engine and helicopter, wind in a field of wheat. Three ash trees growing in a half circle on the edge of the bank of the San Joaquin River, like three sisters born in the valley. First sister, Foothill Ash. Caroline paints the blackbirds that point to the sky. Caroline paints landscapes stolen from her dreams in the night. She says, the highway that takes me out of the desert has become like a wide-winged bird, and I'm scared of being anything but what I am. And the fields are forever drinking water that sprays from sprinkler pumps. This valley, what does it really look like? The hands of my mother as she combs through my black hair. Second sister, California Ash. Gao turns the light on to finish her reading. Gao's hands draw a song sparrow in between the lines she is reading. She thinks, I've spent my life searching for a way to say your name. The intensity of fog in the winter, the grapevines in the early dark, distances shrouded in shapes so familiar they look like foothills smoking. The long-legged man running past on my side. I look for him as I drive. I will eat the grapes, skins and all. Third sister, Two-Petal Ash. Ome taps her foot and presses record. Ome's feet are clay-colored sparrows. Their wings beat to the sound in their hearts. She says, I am going to dance. I have fallen in love in an almond orchard, and I am going to dance. Fresno is three voices and many. It is the kind of city that walks with you, takes a short ride to the store with you, stays later at your place than expected, dances with its slow poem arms at your house party, eats tacos al pastor in a booth with you, gets lost in a suburban neighborhood near Sunnyside with you. It may call you in the evening to tell you to walk outside and look at the moon, a moon that somehow seems like a Fresno moon, low-hanging, orange in the trees, like a barn owl's heart-shaped face looking down from above.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking to Marisol Baca. She is Fresno's Poet Laureate. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Laura, for having me here.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. As we return to some of our favorite stories over this Thanksgiving holiday, we'd be remiss not to include this story about food, specifically the San Joaquin Valley's oldest Japanese confectionery, located in the heart of Fresno's historic Chinatown. FM 89's Carrie Klein and Laura Satsui visited the shop, known as Kogetsu Do, earlier this year, and they began by introducing us to its longtime owner.
My name is Lynn Ikeda Yada, and I'm the owner of Kogetsu Do.
She tells us she's the third generation to run this shop after her grandparents migrated to Chinatown from Hiroshima.
My grandparents started in 1915, and that's a photograph of them on the wall right there. That picture was taken in 1920. They had two sons, Roy, who's the little boy in there, and then my dad, Moss.
Today, Ikeda Yada runs Kogetsu Do almost single-handedly, with a little help from her daughter. She sells ice cream and gifts.
But the star of the show is a display case full of sweets, traditional Japanese pastries called manju and mochi in pink, green, white, and purple, all individually wrapped in plastic wrap on little wooden shelves.
This one has lima beans, red bean smooth. This one is the whole beans with soybean powder on the outside called kinako. There's cinnamon, apple, peach, apricot, cherry, blueberry, raspberry, and boysenberry.
They're like sweet little dumplings, only instead of bread or pasta, the sugary fillings are wrapped in a sticky dough made of rice. She sells mochi ice cream, too.
Right now, I just have vanilla and strawberry.
For authentic mochi, Kogetsudo is the only place between the Bay Area and Southern California. I even have memories of my dad loading up an ice chest full of mochi ice cream before driving to Los Angeles to visit family.
Ikeda Yada says the best part of making mochi is people's reactions when they take that first bite. But ask her what her favorite flavor is, and she can't come up with one.
I don't eat it.
How come?
I guess because you see it every day, you just don't crave for it.
But Carrie and I came hungry.
Which one do you want?
I don't know.
They all look so good.
I know. If I'm going on looks alone, I want to try that one.
The lima bean.
Yeah.
And I'll try the red bean smooth.
Okay, here goes.
It's really squishy. It's a very satisfying feeling, and I haven't even gotten to eating it yet.
So good. It's like so smooth. It's like eating a marshmallow, but without the sugar rush, or like cotton candy.
So like cotton candy, but made out of rice and beans.
Which is why I'm like, oh, is this healthy? Can I eat five?
Ikeda Yada advises us not to. They do have a lot of sugar. Sorry, Laura.
This shop has survived the Depression, the Recession, and even Japanese internment during World War II. Ikeda Yada says a Chinese family kept watch here while her parents and grandparents were sent to concentration camps in Arkansas.
If it ever came down to it, would you ever move the shop?
No, not really, because people know where I'm at. And this is where it all started.
We see why people come back. We also leave with a couple boxes of mochi to share. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Laura Satsui.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Carrie Klein and Alice Daniel,
Laura Satsui and Monica Velez. Technical support from Marv Ellen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Monica Velez. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.